Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to undertake our typical review of what's going on globally and in the U.S. in terms of economics. But then I want to turn to a topic that I guess I would best term ideology in economics. You know, mainstream economics is not forecasting very well and hasn't been for some time. How much of economics is really economic science and how much is non-science, or what I call ideology? Well, we're going to return to that theme in the second part of the show and discuss topics that I believe are ideological, topics such as tax cuts create jobs, free trade benefits everybody, central banks are independent, inflation is always too much money chasing too few goods, productivity determines income inequality. In other words, if you're poor and if income inequality trends are growing, it's your own fault. You're not productive. Interest rates determine investment. Markets are always efficient. Recessions are due to external shocks to a stable system, et cetera, et cetera. Economics is full of this. And this is ideology. This is not factual science. You know, science is where you observe facts and reality, and from that you draw certain conclusions about the relationships between facts and variables. And you then test them to see if they're true. And if they are, you see if they are tight enough that you can forecast. That's what science is about. And economics is partly science, but economics is also partly ideology, which means you're not looking at objective facts and reality, or you're inventing facts, or you are distorting the facts, and you are playing with the relationships between the variables. And there are ways of techniques of doing this that I want to talk about. It's playing with language. It's language games. Ideology is misrepresenting reality. Science is representing reality. And economics is full of this. And that's why you get economists, especially those who are allied with, the business media and academics who pander so they can get big grants and so forth from businesses, et cetera. You know, it's full of it. It's full of it. And sometimes it's difficult to distinguish what's ideology in economics and what is science. They're mixed up. Okay, so we're going to come back to that particular theme, a pet theme of mine for some time. And I've been writing about it, of course. I've been saying, you know, these tax cuts aren't going to create jobs, and they're really not creating jobs. And we'll talk about that, too, in a forthcoming show. I want to talk about what's wrong with labor statistics. Both the job statistics and the wage statistics and consumption and income and so forth. There's a lot of ideology embedded in those statistics. But we'll save that for another show. In the meantime, we will open up this discussion of ideology and economics and those ideological propositions or arguments that I quickly ran through, you know, like tax cuts create jobs, central banks independent, free trade benefits everybody, and all that other nonsense. But first, let's take a look at some of the more important trends that have occurred in the past week here in the U.S. and global economy. We should keep a close watch on some of that. Well, what's really erupted on the global economy stage has been the collapse of the currency in Turkey. Yeah, it's getting a lot of news, particularly in the last day or so. What's going on there? Why is the Turkish currency called the lira? Why is it in free fall? And yes, it is in free fall. It's down 38% since March. 38% collapse of the currency. And you know, we've been talking about the importance of currencies in assessing the state of stability of the global economy. And just to repeat my fundamental argument, the dollar is the driving currency in the world. And when the dollar rises, currency exchange rates are always one currency in relationship to the other. You know, if the dollar goes up, other currencies are going to go down, all things equal. And of course, the U.S. dollar has been rising. There's been, you know, pullback a little bit, so forth, but it's been rising. And the dollar is rising because Federal Reserve is raising interest rates. That drives up the value of the dollar. Why? Because investors elsewhere in the world see rates rising in the U.S. They want to buy into those treasury bonds and other U.S. securities. So they sell their currencies, which increases the supply of their currencies on the market, global money markets, which drives the price of their currencies down. When they're buying dollars, it drives the demand for the U.S. dollar up and raises the dollar. So the dollar goes up, their currencies go down when interest rates rise in the U.S. And that's what's been happening. And will continue to happen according to the Federal Reserve. We're going to get at least two more rate hikes here from the Federal Reserve this year and maybe three next year. We're already, you know, at 2%. The benchmark federal funds rate, which drives all the other interest rates. That rate goes up, the others go up. Okay, and if they raise it two more times, the 20.25% or what they call 25 basis points each time, that's 2.5. And I've been saying for some time that once you hit 2.5% in the benchmark rate, that you're getting close to a credit crunch. I do not believe that the Fed can raise much more than 2.5%, maybe not even that. But if it does, not much more, without precipitating a credit crunch, which means recession. That's why I've been predicting recession late next year, if the Fed continues raising rates, which, by the way, is about half of what it raised rates in 2008. Yeah, the Fed clearly raised interest rates to 5.25% in 2007-8, right into the obvious recession that was coming. And then, of course, the financial crash exacerbated that big time. Yeah, 5.25%. It won't even get anywhere near that. And the same thing's going to happen this time because of changes in the economy and overhang of massive debt, particularly corporate debt that exists in the U.S. economy. But the Fed is pushing it. Why is the Fed pushing it? Well, because it's got to attract borrowers for U.S. securities in order to finance the $1 trillion annual deficits that Trump has created because of his massive tax cuts, defense hikes, and other policies. The Fed is raising rates to fund the deficit and the debt, which is going to be over $10 trillion over the next decade, on top of the $21 trillion we already have. That's why the Fed's raising rates. That's why the dollar's going up. That's why emerging market economies are going, their currencies are going down. And of course, Turkey is at the forefront of this collapse, 40%. But there's other countries' currencies that are not too much further off. No, Argentina down 30-some percent. Forced Argentina to go and get a loan from the IMF. Well, Turkey doesn't want to get a loan because you get a loan from the IMF. The IMF says, okay, austerity time. Go squeeze your workforce and your small businesses and average folks. Raise your interest rates. Create a recession. Well, Argentina's already in a recession. Its GDP collapsed 6%, latest data. But they don't care because these are the financial speculators under Macri who took over that government with the help of the U.S., you see. And they're just enriching themselves. Okay, so it's not just Turkey. There's Argentina. There's South Africa. There's Brazil. Other major economies. Indonesia, India showing trouble with their currencies. So raising interest rates in the U.S. Has this major impact on currencies. And that includes China. Although the impact of the rising dollar on the China is not as serious as these other economies. But nonetheless, it's forced the Chinese currency, the yuan, renminbi, whatever you want to call it, out to the edge of the band in which China allows its currency to fluctuate. In other words, the devaluation edge of the band. And Chinese Central Bank, People's Bank of China, has been buying up yuan, renminbi, in markets, global markets, to keep it from devaluing further. Well, as rates continue to rise, it's going to be harder and harder for the People's Bank of China, its central bank, to continue purchasing to prevent a devaluation. And at some point, that devaluation is going to break out of the band. And when that happens, the psychological awareness of, even China's currency is devaluing, not just Turkey, Argentina, and so forth, that's going to have a big psychological effect around the world. A currency war. Yes, it will precipitate a currency war. I've recently written on that. Check out my blog, jackrasmus.com. And what may push it over the edge there in China is Trump's trade war with China. He's trying to bully China like he's done with all the rest of the trading allies, and they've pretty much conceded and come hat in hand to Washington. He's getting what he wants from them, including Mexico and Canada very soon before the election, I predict. But China's another story. He's not going to have it so easy. And China's doing a tit-for-tat tariff response. But, China can only do so much tariff response because it doesn't purchase that much from the U.S., compared to U.S. purchasing from China. So China's going to, if the trade war continues, if Trump keeps driving the trade war with China, China's going to have to respond in other ways. And I predict the number one way is probably just let its currency devalue. You see, it doesn't have to declare a devaluation. It just has to stop intervening in global markets to keep the yuan from further devaluing and saying, this is global markets. We're following the markets, right? We want to be a market society here. You Westerners are putting pressure on us to follow markets. That's all we're doing. You see, so all you have to do is not intervene, and the yuan will devalue. And then all these other currencies will devalue even faster. But let's get back to Turkey. Right? 38% collapse. Well, is that all attributed to the dollar? No. The dollar is a big part of it, set it all off. But global speculators pile in, you see, financial foreign exchange currency speculators, hedge funds and all those guys, whenever they see a significant move in a price of any kind, and this is a price of a currency, the exchange rate, they jump in. And they short it. In other words, they bet that it's going to fall even further, which drives it down even further. And that's what's happening here. global speculators are jumping in now and shorting the Turkish lira, which is causing it to decline even further and faster. On top of that, Trump is fanning the flames of the whole thing. Well, how's he doing that? Well, he just put more tariffs on Turkish steel. Yeah, I don't know if they have aluminum, but more tariffs on that. And in the press, what you see is, oh, he's making this demand that Turkey release this Christian pastor, I forget his name here, back to the U.S., release him. What Trump is doing is using the crisis in Turkey and its currency to leverage some political domestic appeal with the evangelicals in the United States. You know, they want that pastor released, so he's willing to create a foreign relations issue in order to pander to the evangelicals in the U.S. But, you know, what's really behind it is the U.S. is sending a signal to Turkey. Oh, you're getting too close to Russia. You know, you're buying Russian military goods, you know, anti-missile missiles. We don't like that. You got to buy it from us. Well, Turkey says, well, Russia's cheaper, you know. And besides, you know, your CIA tried to throw me under the bus, pull off a coup, you know. So why should I buy from you? I'm going to buy from Russia. Well, the U.S. says, well, we don't like that. And you're getting too close to Iran, Turkey. Erdogan is the president there. Erdogan, you're getting too close to Iran. We don't like that. And you've gone to China to borrow loans from China. No, no, you're supposed to borrow from the U.S. You're supposed to borrow dollars. Well, they have been borrowing dollars, and that's part of Turkey's problem. Most of their debt is rolled up in dollarized debt. They've been borrowing from the West, particularly U.S. banks and European banks, in order to finance their economic development, which, you know, has been pretty aggressive. But they're loaded up with debt now, you see, dollarized debt. Those emerging market countries that are heavily, heavily exposed to dollarized debt, dollar borrowing in dollars, are those whose currencies are collapsing the fastest because the dollar is rising. You see, when you have debt and the value of the cost of the debt rises, right, and your currency is falling, you got to spend even more of your currency to service that dollarized debt. In other words, service meaning paying the principal and interest. The cost is going up. But your ability to pay for it in your own currency is going down as your currency declines. So what you got to do is borrow even more to pay the old principal and interest. You know, and then if the U.S. don't like your policies, they simply prevent you from borrowing more. And then your economy collapses and whoever's in power politically collapses. You know, that's one of the ways, one of the many ways that the U.S. exercises economic imperialism. The dollar is a weapon, a big weapon. And global interest rates that influences is a big weapon. Trade is another weapon. And the U.S. employs these weapons very cleverly. And that's what's going on in Turkey here. So this big global geopolitics behind this release this pastor appeal to evangelicals. Well, Trump gets two bites of the apple then, right? And he's fanning the flames. And the global speculators, hedge fund guys, are jumping in and fanning the flames of the currency collapse. And if the currency collapses, well, then inflation rises because most of these other emerging market countries have to buy, in other words, through imports, many essentials and staples. And if the value of their currency is down, well, then the cost of those staples goes up. You know, oftentimes this is food stuff, this is medical supplies, etc. You can see the very extreme impact of this in Venezuela, where the U.S. has essentially for several years now shut off Venezuelan access to dollars. And inflation's gone through the roof. That's all part of destabilizing that economy there, which has really been destabilized significantly. But it's all, you know, it's about the U.S. manipulating currency and so forth, because the dollar is the trading, the global trading currency. You can buy anything with dollars, right? I mean, who wants to take Argentine pesos for their shipment of medical supplies to Argentina when Argentine pesos are collapsing in value? Well, you'll just take a loss if you sell and allow them to buy in pesos. But, you know, okay, Argentina, you want the medical supplies? Well, then you pay in dollars. Well, then Argentina has to go out and buy the dollars with a collapsing currency. And if it doesn't have enough dollars, what does it do? Goes to the IMF, says, give me some dollars, IMF. And IMF gave Argentina $50 billion. Ah, but only with the understanding, austerity, squeeze, you pay us back, but you squeeze it out of the rest of your populace. And if you know you're a big financial businessman running Argentina, oh, that's okay, as long as you don't squeeze us. Okay, so Turkey has perhaps become the most indebted in terms of external dollar debt than all of these emerging markets, is borrowed in dollars. Now, that's the key, because where did it borrow it from? From European banks and U.S. banks. Banks got the dollars. That's where it borrowed it. And heavily from Italy and Italian banks. Yes, UniCredit, BBV, and a couple others there are really exposed to loans to Turkey. And if Turkey cannot pay the principal and interest on those loans, then those Italian banks, UniCredit and others, are in deep trouble. Well, they're already in deep trouble, the Italian banks. They already have a half a trillion dollars of non-performing bank loans from the crisis since 2008. A half of $500 billion of non-performing. Non-performing means they gave out these loans, you know, usually to Italian companies and other companies, and they're not paying it. Whoever borrowed it is not paying the principal or the interest or both. So they're non-performing, they say. Well, a lot of those loans from Italian banks also were made to Turkey. So if Turkey collapses its currency, it can't pay the principal and interest on its Italian bank loans. Well, what happens to Italian banks? Oh, they're in trouble. And the signs of their trouble is the collapse of the stock values of the Italian banks, and that's going on right now. Okay, so this thing in Turkey, if it continues and gets worse, will result in defaults in the big Italian banks. And that can have a bigger contagion effect. We're talking about contagion effects from this a Turkish situation. You know, it spills over to European banks. Well, you see European bank stocks declining here, and the European stock market, and the U.S. stock market to some extent too, because probably Citibank, Citigroup is exposed here. All right. So other European banks. You see, the financial system is linked. They're all linked together. That's why you get such contagion in crisis situations. You know, one node in the contagion network here can't service its debt, and that means the debt and the losses are transferred to whoever it can't pay, and then they can't pay somebody else, and then they can't pay somebody else. You see, it just spills over. Okay. The key problem here is the massive amount of dollarized debt that Turkey borrowed from the U.S. and Europe that has to be repaid in dollars with a currency, the lira, that's collapsing. And it's all traceable back to the Federal Reserve, the U.S. Federal Reserve raising interest rates. Now, Turkey has to, you know, massive, hundreds of billions of dollars in dollarized external debt has to be repaid with a collapsing currency. And one third of this debt that Turkey has is due for payment next year, rollover. It has to be rolled over. In other words, rollover means you borrow even more to pay the old principal and interest on the old debt. That's what they mean when they say rollover. Well, what banks are going to give, global banks are going to give Turkey any more money to pay off its old debt when its currency is collapsing? Not many. Well, that forces them to go to IMF. But Turkey doesn't want to go to the IMF. You know, Turkey did that, went through that ringer back about 15 years ago, as a lot of countries did after 2001, right? And got stuck with IMF. Had to give up much of its national production to pay off the IMF. They don't want to get stuck in that. Yeah. Now the Argentinian finance capitalists, they don't care. You know, long as they protect their interests, they'll squeeze Argentinians, which they're doing. Same in Brazil. You know, they're a bunch of bandits. They're a bunch of they destroy their own economies, but they don't care. Okay, so in order to borrow more money, Turkey has to raise what it will pay in terms of interest. And right now, its bond rates are at 20%. In other words, buy Turkish bonds here, and Turkey will pay you 20% interest. As the currency collapses, the bond rates go up, and that's when the speculators jump in, you see. Turkey's external debt, as we call this, the dollarized external debt, is 53% of its GDP. And as I said, a third has to be repaid next year. Well, Argentina is 37%. South Africa is 50%. Brazil, 33%. That's why these are the currencies that are collapsing, you see. Because interest rates are rising. The debt they borrowed, massive debt they borrowed, has to be repaid in dollars, and their currencies are declining, and that forces them to raise interest rates. But that causes domestically, that causes a deeper recession, you see. So you can trace this thing all the way back to Trump. U.S. deficits, $1 trillion a year, got to raise the interest rates, dollar goes up, currencies elsewhere go down. They have to raise their interest rates, deep recessions. You know, it all begins in Washington. Trump is depressing the rest of the world economically. Okay, so interest rates are an important element here. But, here's another area. Interest rates are causing a big problem. As I've been predicting for some time now, finally, it's starting to, in the last couple of months, hit the U.S. housing commercial real estate markets big time. As rates go up, drives up other mortgage rates and so forth, and the June sales and projections for August, September sales for U.S. housing is significantly down. In other words, the housing sector and the commercial housing property sector are starting to slow down dramatically. Okay, so watch that. That means it's going to have an impact on the U.S. economy as well. But it's being offset by households borrowing on credit, you see. To keep their, they're not getting the wage increases, so they're borrowing on credit, household credit, credit cards and installment loans and so forth to keep the consumption going. And they're pulling out their savings as well. We're going to come back to this whole savings thing, savings rate, you know, because this is another example. Recently, the U.S. Redefined the savings rate. U.S. savings rate had dropped to like 3% of income was being saved in the U.S. Used to be double digits, you see. Well, that's because people aren't saving, actually dragging money out of their savings in order to maintain their level of consumption. Oh, but the U.S. statistics didn't like that, so they redefined the savings rate and doubled it overnight. See, this goes on quite a bit. This is part of ideology as well. If you don't like the statistic, redefine it, and it'll go away. Well, that's exactly what Clinton did in the late 1990s. As poverty was rising, he redefined what poverty was, and it went away. Or a good part of it. And, you know, Ronald Reagan didn't like the fact that jobs were being, real jobs and real industries being shifted offshore and manufacturing was declining as a percent of the U.S. economy. So he defined making hamburgers as manufacturing. Yeah, I mean, putting lettuce and tomatoes on a fast food burger was manufacturing, you see. This is how they play games with definitions, you know, in the very, very fine print, you know, and then of the labor statistics. And then you get big changes in labor statistics under Bush, where instead of, you know, looking at inflation prices, consumer prices, they come up with a chained price index, which just smooths out the inflation from year to year. You know, and if you lower the estimation of inflation, you're going to boost real GDP because gross domestic product is nominal GDP. In other words, prices times all the goods and services sold. Then you adjust it, take out the inflation, and you get the real GDP number. But if you underestimate inflation, you boost the real GDP number. And they've been doing that. And then, of course, you redefine in 2013 the elements of GDP as they did under Obama, and you get another boost to GDP. You know, you play with your definitions and your statistical methodology. You can, push the reported stats in the direction that you want. Less inflation, more jobs, etc. Well, they can't even push the wages. All they can do is push it up to stagnant wage increases. You know, because it's not unlimited. They can't just falsify this stuff. It has to be done very cleverly and subtly. Yeah, wages are actually declining. We'll talk about that. Well, we have in previous shows, but we'll talk about some more. That's part of ideology, too. Misrepresenting the facts, you see. Misrepresentation is what ideology and economics is about. You know, the empirical reality will tell you what the facts are, but, you know, let's distort that. Let's pervert those facts and divert those facts. And we do that with statistics. You know, the reports that you get on jobs, those aren't the real job numbers. Those are statistics about the raw data on jobs. Statistical methodologies that manipulate the raw data. You got to read the very small print in the Bureau of Labor Statistics, their definitions, and in the other two major sources of U.S. economic data, the Bureau of Economic Analysis and the Census. Department in the Commerce Department, right? Those are the three sources. And we're going to get some more manipulation of that because Trump has proposed the let's take the Bureau of Labor Statistics and put it under the Commerce Department. Yeah. All right. So U.S. inflation data, 2.9%. And of course, it's chain prices, so it's actually more than that, you know. I'd say it's probably 3.2 or something, you know, inflation's rising 3.2% around there. And wages are rising only 2.2%. So real wages are falling at least 1% a year on average. On average. And as I said last week, you know, that means that the average is pulled up by those at the high end who are getting wage increases. The top 10% are getting wage increases. You know, people in tech and professionals and so forth, managers, which means people in the middle or below, the median or below, are actually making, you know, a lot less than's being reported. And that's where most of the working force is located. So real wages are, you know, falling even more than 1%. Inflation is going to go higher, too. They just released a report on the Consumer Price Index that shows rising rents constitute 66% of this 2.9% increase in inflation. Rents. And it's going to rise further. And then, of course, Trump's tariffs on steel and aluminum are starting already to push up the price of automobiles, appliances, and so forth. So inflation is going to get worse here, which means real wages are going to decline even faster, which means households are going to have to borrow more to maintain their standard of living. But the cost of borrowing more is going up because the Fed's raising rates, you see. This cannot continue. The shell game, economic policy shell game going on, is not going to work. But Trump and his buddies don't care as long as they give themselves big tax cuts. You know, they're happy as a pig in you know what right now. Okay, one other report that's of importance here I want to talk about. Just came out this week. Retirees. Grandma, grandpa, folks over 65 are increasingly being squeezed. And we have some interesting indicators of that. Well, first of all, the fastest growing segment, age segment of the labor force in this country is people over 65. That's growing by double digits, 65 to 75. In other words, people who are retired are going back to work because their standard of living and their income can't keep up. So they got to go back to work. The whole idea of retirement is disappearing in this country. And not just in this country, it's everywhere, right, under capitalism. Fastest growing segment, going back to work. It's also the fastest growing segment of bankruptcy filings. And this was a recent report. The median debt that seniors who are filing for bankruptcy have is $101,000. That's huge. That's the median. In the 1990s, this particular age group, 65 to 74, according to this report, 2.1% of this age group in the 90s filed for bankruptcy. In the most recent 3 years of reporting, 2013 to 16, that 2.1% has risen to 12.2%. From 2 to 12% of that age group is filing for bankruptcy. And keep in mind, the personal bankruptcy filing rules were significantly tightened for individuals, liberalized for businesses, but tightened for individuals under George W. Bush. So, you know, it's harder to file for bankruptcy, but more and more people are doing it. 12%. That's like a 200% increase from 2 to 12. According to this recent study. So more seniors are going bankrupt and going back to work, trying not to go bankrupt. And you can say, well, you know, we got more retirees. That's why it went from 2% to 12%. No, no. This age group, 65, 74, increased from since the 90s. And it has increased from 17% of the population to only 19%. So a 2% increase in the population of older Americans, but a 200% increase in those filing bankruptcies, even though it's harder to file bankruptcies than ever before. Okay. Well, why are the seniors in such bad shape? Well, first of all, their pension plans have been wiped out. You know what we call defined benefit pensions? The guarantee is so much per month, per year service. You know, those have been, since Reagan, those have been eliminated since Reagan and replaced with phony 401k plans. And the record is very clear. 401ks have miserably failed in providing retirement. But 401ks allow the banks to get in there and charge fees. You see, that's what it's all about. Get rid of these real pension plans and let the bankers, Wall Street, get their hands on your pension, which is what they've done. Collapse of defined benefit plans and rise of phony 401k plans. A big reason why folks are over 65 are in trouble. But there's other reasons, too. One is Social Security and Medicare. The costs are being increasingly paid under Social Security and Medicare by individuals who are on Social Security and Medicare. In other words, the cost sharing has gone up on Social Security and Medicare. The average healthcare spending as a percent of Social Security income is now 34%. In other words, if you're over 60, 65, 67, and you get so much Social Security, I think the median Social Security payment is like $1,200 a month or something like that, right? Well, out-of-pocket expenses for Medicare, medical health care coverage, 34% of that is still going for out-of-pocket. And for those who are over 75, they're spending 40 to 74% of that $1,200 for out-of-pocket medical health care costs. So that's the biggest, one of the biggest expenditures when you get old. You know, you get old, you get sick, you have problems. You go to the hospital a lot, right? Well, people are being forced to pay more and more. Medicare has not been keeping up. You know, and they're giving more and more of this Medicare to this Medicare Advantage, the private insurance companies, you know. That's what Republicans are doing. They're privatizing quietly, a Trojan horse here, privatizing Medicare through the back door. And Republicans are going to give even more to Medicare Advantage, which is the foot in the door, the nose of the camel under the tent of the health insurance companies into the Medicare system. And, of course, household debt and interest payments for the over 65 have risen significantly as well. Credit card debt is rising twice as fast as the rest of the populace for folks over 65. And since 2010, they've gotten whatever savings they've had in the bank, they've gotten virtually no interest on it. Only now it's been rising a little bit, but for under Obama for 8 years, zip zero on your savings. Another reason why people say, well, I'm not earning anything, I might as well spend it. And then, of course, we have the collapse of the savings rate, which has been ideologically overturned here. And overnight, we get a new definition of the savings rate, and savings rate goes back up to 7%, you know. This is part of this manipulation in the great tradition of chain prices and GDP redefinitions and poverty rate definition changes and so forth. Okay, so, you know, I would say along with the Turkey situation news here, this report on retirees is extremely important, as well as rising inflation and interest rates in the housing market and so forth in the U.S. Okay, let's turn now, and I want to talk again, pick up this theme, which we will develop here in subsequent weeks, about ideology in economics. All right. Ideological propositions. These are kind of statements about economic facts and economic relationships between economic variables and so forth. You know, my definition of ideology, it's not an ism, it's not communism, it's not conservatism, liberalism. You know, that's not what ideology is. Ideology is word games. Ideology is playing with language in order to distort the meaning, the fundamental original meaning of something, and come up with another meaning for it. This idea tax cuts create jobs, you know, I've railed against that. No evidence that tax cuts create jobs. Phony, you know. Supply side economics is the theory offshoot from this ideology about tax cuts creating jobs. Supply side ideology meaning that, oh, if you only give businesses more money by cutting their taxes, they will have more to invest in production and expand their businesses, which means they will hire more people when they expand, which means people will get more wage income and consumption will rise because they'll have more wage income. You know, that's the causal string behind this idea that tax cuts create jobs. But the big problem is, the big assumption hidden here, it sounds logically correct, but the big assumption is that, oh, if you give businesses more money, they will invest. As I've been saying, my research shows you give them more money, maybe some will trickle down, you know, maybe 20%, but most of it will go into financial asset markets, stock markets, bond markets, exchange markets, derivatives, or it'll just be hoarded. And that's really what we see, you know, this Trump tax cut thing. Well, as of April, May, it's resulted in $427 billion in stock buybacks, not counting dividend payouts. Most of this money being brought back under the, from offshore is going into the stock market and being used to pay for bonds and so forth by U.S. companies and investors and banks. Or it's just being hoarded, or it's going offshore. Well, not so much anymore because emerging markets are in trouble. And, of course, it's reduced government tax revenue here by about $400 billion this year. Yeah, they got the tax cut. They're taking it. But they're not really using it to invest in new jobs and so forth. Well, wait a minute. People say, wait a minute. You know, we got new jobs going, being created. Yeah, but is that the result of the tax cut? Can you show, you know, a one-for-one causal relationship between the tax cut and those jobs? There's lots of other reasons why you may have job creation going on. Not necessarily tax cut. Well, the people who engage in ideology about that, supply-side economic theory nonsense, simply assume that there's that relationship without showing it. So tax cuts create jobs is one of the big ideological myths of mainstream economics. By the way, if you go back far enough, go back to Adam Smith, he was very clear. David Hume and others, raise taxes. That's what will stimulate jobs and productivity. Yeah, just the opposite, you know. Classical economics held just the opposite view. that tax cuts create jobs. The view is tax hikes create jobs, forces businesses, because of rising costs, to invest in new technology, to raise productivity, and therefore they hire more people. Just the opposite. Okay, another ideological proposition is central banks are independent of government, in other words. Well, what part of government? You really think it's they're independent of the banking committees in the House and the Senate, and those few people who come from the banking sector, by the way, do a stint in government. And they're the ones who make sure the people who get appointed to the Federal Reserve are people who are pro-banker. You know, I just wrote a book here, Central Bankers at the End of the Ropes, which looks at the origins of the Federal Reserve back in 1913. And who ran the central bank? The bankers ran the central bank. They were all local bankers. And the Federal Reserve then, and still today, is a corporation paid for, its operating expenses paid for by the bankers. And each Fed district is run by a 9-person committee, at least 2/3 of which are bankers and non-banking buddies. And the president is selected by that majority of bankers in those districts and is sent to, participates in the Federal Open Market Committee, which determines interest rate shifts. You know, my argument was, the bankers don't say raise rates 0.25% or this or that. No, but the major shifts in policy are determined indirectly, opaquely, behind the scenes, by the banking system and the big bankers who run the Federal Reserve indirectly in terms of strategic directions. Central banks aren't independent. You can see reviews on my blog and my website, Kyklos Productions, KYKLOSProductions.com, of the book. And now, by the way, I got another one coming out here later this year, just finished, on a prequel to the Federal Reserve, looking at the evolution of central banking in the U.S. from Alexander Hamilton and the origins of the country and the Constitution up to the creation of the Federal Reserve. And clearly, it was the bankers who ran the central bank's experiments at that time. The central bank, the Fed, of course, screwed up royally during the Depression, and the government instituted some reforms, tried to put some public people on the governing board and so forth. But, you know, the bankers just came back and more subtly, cleverly influenced the Federal Reserve. Well, that's my main argument. Central banks are not independent, but independent from whom is the question. Not the government. Independent from the banking system is the real question that's never raised in mainstream economics. Another favorite proposition ideological is free trade benefits all. What nonsense. Even average folks don't believe that anymore. And economists go through all these gyrations, you know, these logical gyrations to show how productivity rises and everybody benefits from free trade. Yeah, I mean, Samuelson, Stolper, these are economists, you know, theories and so forth, you know, it's all nonsense. It's not a zero-sum game. You know, certain people lose, and usually the communities and the workers that lose on both sides, but, you know, the capitalists may benefit on both sides. Productivity determines income inequality, another favorite ideological proposition going back to the late 19th century mainstream economics, argued that, if your income is low, it's because you aren't productive enough. Go get productive. Go get an education, and you will raise your wages. So it's your fault. The victims who don't have enough income are the cause of the inequality, you see, which says nothing about how the finance capitalist elite manipulates prices of all kinds to enrich themselves beyond all dreams here in the last decade or so. Markets are always efficient. That's why the markets cause these big collapses, which wipe out trillions and trillions of dollars periodically. Oh, that's efficient, yeah. And so on and so forth. Ideology in economics. Well, as I said a while ago, you get this ideology because of manipulation of reality. You can observe reality, and if you don't like what the conclusions are from that observation, you can change the original propositions, the original statements based on observable facts in economics. Well, how do you change them? You see, that's the and who are these people that change them? Well, you know, they're the people in editorial pages of the Wall Street Journal, Heritage Foundation, Hoover Institute, you know, University of Chicago, all, you know, this is the apparatus, the institutional apparatus where a lot of these ideas are cleverly redefined, restructured, restated. And how do they do that? Well, there are certain techniques of manipulation. One I call inversion. Invert the basic relationships between the variables, rearrange the structure, right? And you come out with a different meaning. Reversal, change the direction of cause and effect relationships between the basic facts and propositions in an idea. Insertion, introduce foreign and often contradictory elements into the original idea and redefine it. Conversion, declare and interpret correlations as cause and effect relationships when they're not. They're just correlations. Delete certain fundamental elements in an idea, you know, and that goes along with insert false ideas. Substitute, delete and then insert fundamentally new ideas or proposition, merging two previous contradictory ideas into something totally new. Eliminate any history, in other words, dehistoricize the whole idea. Time, play with time here. Redefine particular as the general and partial as the whole, right? The temporary as the permanent. These are, you know, quick run through here of language games, manipulation of original ideas through these techniques, substitution, deletion, insertion, conversion, etc., to come up with a total different meaning. So you take classical economics, tax hikes create jobs, and you end up with tax cuts create jobs. Or you get free trade benefits everybody, right? Or inflation is always too much money chasing too few goods. Or you are income poor because you are not productive. Or markets are always efficient. You know, it's full of nonsense. But it's hard for the average folks reading this stuff to separate out the false assumptions that constitute economic ideology that distorts, perverts, obfuscates economic science. And economics is full of this, both ideology and science. But in mainstream economics is more and more relying on ideology. Why? Because the ideology justifies the economic policies that enrich the rich. Trump tax cuts, right? Create jobs. Every tax cut that we've had here since Reagan under neoliberalism, especially under Bush and Obama, is ideology. Okay. We'll come back to some of these themes next week. I'm sure we're going to have some very interesting latest developments. Watch Turkey.